remove section two in the judiciary version, which runs from line 12, page one, to page, or line three, page two.
Three.
Line three, yeah, page two, line three. You want them all in one, or you want them?
Sure.
And then I would move that we add.
From the original version.
From the original version, lines, on page two, lines one through four.
Does everyone understand the amendment?
And conforming title.
And the title change.
And conforming title amendment.
Title change on line two, page one, removing, and in the United States Congress.
Discussion of the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment?
I just wanted to ask.
Representative Brown.
What is the status at the federal level of the other states that have adopted term limiting?
Only three.
The congressional terms. Have they held up in court or?
Yes, they all have.
Have they?
California did.
Colorado, Oklahoma.
Are they held up in court?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the U.S. Congress?
No, there was a recent court case in the state of Washington that had to do with limiting terms on the local government level that the courts threw the term limitations out. So, still up in the air.
I guess the state of Washington rejected it, the term limitation.
No, that was
before. I've always thought it was a stretch, but anyway, we have a new CS before us that incorporates the original, the first Boyer Amendment, and now the Sharp Amendment that limits the bill essentially through the terms. There was no objection to the Sharp Amendment. So without objection, that amendment has been adopted with the title change language amendment as well. Is there further discussion on the CS? Representative Kopanen?
I move that the CS next committee refer with individual recommendations.
And the accompanying fiscal.
And the accompanying fiscal. Law.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Let's see what other kind of damage we can get into.
Could we break a little bit before time to give someone a chance to go down?
Why don't we, I think we may as well break then to a call of the chair. So House Finance will recess to the call of the chair.
Okay.
Sign this. Finance Committee meeting will come to order. Members present, Representative Brown, okay. Navarre, and Larson.
What do we do? Why don't you tell?
39 we're going to take up first.
I still just count five.
Yeah, and Ramona's in her office.
Oh,
we can. Finance Committee meeting will come to order. Members present, Representative Brown, Navarre, McLean, Homer, Larson, and very soon, Representative Barnes. We're going to take up first committee substitute for Senate Bill 39.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Austin. I'm legislative aide to Senator Pat Pourchaud, the sponsor of Senate Bill 39. It's an act relating to technical revisions in the Permanent Fund Corporation statutes. The Office of Management and Budget, the Commission on the Future of the Permanent Fund, and the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees have all identified several areas in which there are needed clarifications of language and statute in order to ensure the legality of the current corporation practices. Basically, those are in six areas. Language consistency, adjustments to the legislated list of investments, inflation proofing or the method of inflation proofing deposits, litigation revenue, timely transfers from DNR, and asset allocation. In language consistency, the terms Alaska Permanent Fund and Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation are used inconsistently. The first term should refer to assets owned by the state of Alaska, and the second term should refer only to the government instrumentality created to manage and invest those assets. The revisions in this bill modify the statutes to use those terms correctly and consistently. Adjustments to the legislated list of investments. The corporation is limited to investments of the type specified in statute. Unfortunately, the list has not been updated to reflect the present state of financial markets. Sections 12 and 13 of SB 39 make it possible for the corporation to take advantage of investment opportunities in AA-rated or better municipal and state bonds and single-A-rated corporate debt securities. This section also provides specific authorization for investments in money market instruments. In those statutes, there is deleted the reference to readily available secondary markets for certificates of deposit of Alaska Savings and Loan Associations, mutual savings banks, and credit unions, because those markets do not exist. Reference to state-chartered savings and loan associations in Alaska is deleted because such SNLs do not exist. As for the method of inflation-proofing deposits, money is added to the principal of the fund once a year to offset the loss of value of the principal due to inflation. The inflation-proofing monthly deposits to the principal from mineral lease royalties and rents can be a very complex task if each deposit is inflation-proofed at a different rate depending on when in the year it was added to the fund. To ensure that the simplest and most conservative method of inflation-proofing is used, Section 20 of the legislation mandates that all deposits to the principal of the fund shall be inflation-proofed at the full annual rate. This change in statute conforms to the current practices of the corporation. Litigation revenue. Treating all interest received as contributions to principal is the course of action currently being used by the corporation, but it is not statutorily mandated. Section 2 of the proposed legislation ensures that all interest on the fund's share of any settlements or awards will be transferred to the fund, and that both the original amount due the fund and any interest it has garnered shall be counted as deposits to the principal of the fund. This represents the most conservative approach to the question. It adds the greatest amount possible to the principal of the fund and prevents unpredictable and destabilizing surges in the corporation's earnings. Timely transfers from DNR. Current law mandates the transfer of funds due to the fund from royalty and lease income from the Department of Natural Resources on a monthly basis. During the 30-day period between transfers, DNR can accumulate sizable balances of monies that will eventually be transferred to the fund. During times of exceptionally high oil prices and high production, the monthly transfers have been as much as $55 million. Section 3 of Senate Bill 39 changes the process so that the fund receives a transfer whenever $3 million owed the fund accumulates at DNR, or once a month, whichever is sooner. It also requires that the transfers take place within 3 banking days. This will allow the fund to gain the greatest possible benefit from the monies that have been constitutionally and statutorily dedicated for that purpose. Under asset allocation, there have been some changes requested by the Permanent Fund Corporation. The corporation is now prohibited from investing more than 50% of its funds in a combination of U.S. corporate stocks and bonds and all foreign investments. Having corporate bonds, which is currently 10.16% of the fund, included in the limitation makes it legally impossible for the corporation to meet its goals. Section 13 of the bill removes domestic and foreign corporate debt securities, bonds rated A or better, from the combined asset allocation limit now in place and limits them to 5% of the total investments of the fund. We also, the sponsor has submitted an amendment which is which would amend the current statutes to bring the investment officers of the corporation under the conflict of interest statutes 3950. And that amendment provides that the investment officers employed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, as well as members of the board and the executive director, are covered under conflict of interest statutes. Under the policies of the former executive director, investment officers of the corporation were subject to strict reporting requirements. There is no evidence to suggest that these policies will not continue. However, the prudent course is to establish those requirements in statute. The Permanent Fund Corporation has no objection to that amendment. And we have Jim Kelly of the Permanent Fund Corporation here to answer technical questions.
Representative Brown. I have on my desk a letter dated May 6, 1992 from Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, saying the committee substitute for SB 39 finance, and I don't have any finance substitute in my packet, and I'm just getting confused as to which version are we discussing?
We're working on the House version.
Is there a proposed finance version?
I don't have one.
On May 6th, they're still talking to the original version?
There is a proposed finance version.
So are the issues raised in Mr. Andrews' letter resolved?
I haven't seen the letter. We have not received the letter.
No, it doesn't look like it's been resolved. The first part of that amendment's there, but the second part is not.
I can't even figure out where it goes, Mr. Chairman, since it's... referencing a different version of the bill.
Well, I think on page 2, line 6, is where...
There's an AA one between, yeah.
I think it replaces the language in number 3. Page 2. Lines 5 and 6. Is there anyone here from the department? No.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Andrews, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. The letter that Representative Brown was referring to was a letter that I addressed to Representative Larson on May the 6th, 1992. And in that letter, the department has a concern with one portion of this legislation, and that is that the recognition of interest income that's earned on money while those monies are in trust or in litigation status outside of the state should be accounted for in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And that, in a nutshell, is our concern with the methodology as to the receipt of those interest earnings. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understood that. Could you go through it one more time and show me exactly where in the bill you're referencing?
Yes. Essentially, what we need to do is on line 6 of page 1, the term should be the funds possessive principal and interest consists of, and it should be to include the term and interest. And then the other change would be on page 2, section 3. And section 3 should be deleted.
Which version are you?
The judiciary version? Oh.
My apology.
I'm
sorry.
Thank you. This is a question to Mr. Andrews. Is the effect of this amendment to put less money in the permanent fund?
No. The only effect of this amendment is to account for the money in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. As to how the money, whether the money comes into the principal portion of the, or the corpus of the permanent fund, or to the unrestricted earnings portion, that would be dictated by the accounting methodology.
It was my understanding this amendment put less money in the permanent fund.
No, in total, the monies would flow to the permanent fund. As to the corpus, there may be a situation where the income is earned while the money is outside of the permanent fund may not receive that.
So it could result in less money in the permanent fund?
More.
To the corpus of the permanent fund. There could result less money, yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Barnes.
Well, the way I'm reading this bill, overall, this bill puts the practices that you've been presently doing into statute, and it allows more money over the long term. Is that not correct? Because you will be taking more out of the earnings reserve account for inflation proofing, and by the year 2000 there will be no money in the earnings reserve account. Is that not true?
I would have to defer to Mr. Kelly.
We have Mr. Kelly here from the permanent.
Regarding your question, it doesn't really change what has happened as far as money comes from the earnings.
But you have, to this point in time, not had statutory authority, but by this law that we have before us, you would have the statutory authority, and because as time goes on, it will take more money out of the earnings reserve account to inflation-proof because the fund itself keeps growing. And every time we inflation-proof, we have to inflation-proof, or we're inflation-proofing, by the year 2000, we won't have any money in the earnings reserve, and then we have to take it out of the general fund. Isn't that true?
Well, but the larger the fund gets, the more income it produces, and the greater the availability for money to inflation-proof. As for this, Mr. Chairman, as for this this issue here, which has just been raised, unfortunately, I had never seen it before, but in the past, it has been the corporation's position that money that is due to the principal should be treated as money that's due to the principal, and if it's an escrow. And we had had opinions in the past from our accountants that that was the proper way to treat that money. One of the reasons we wanted to make it clear in this statute is to make it clear to everybody that the money that is due to the principal of the permanent fund, while it's sitting in escrow somewhere else, that that money should go to the principal. We don't want to include it as net income. It doesn't have anything to do with us earning income. It's external to us. We think it just flows properly to the principal. So we don't support the amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond. Enclosed or attached with my letter of May 6, 1992, is a memorandum of March 7, 1988, discussing the accounting practices of how this interest should be accounted for to the permanent fund. And with that, again, our position is that it should be accounted for in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles.
Kelly? This is just one opinion of what generally accepted accounting principles. We'd argue that the practice we're promoting in this bill is generally accepted accounting principles.
You guys don't seem to agree on accounting principles.
Put it into law and it's squared away. I mean, it's up to you to decide which way you want to go with it. This has been our position that the money sitting in somebody else's account that is due to our principal, and it's being argued about while it's sitting there, any of the money that it earns ought to be included as principal.
Okay, and if we don't pass this, what happens to the interest earned on the principal or on the money that's in escrow?
Well, we would treat it the same way this has happened in the past. We put it into principal.
Our position in the Department of Revenue is that whether it goes to principal or income should be decided according to generally accepted accounting principles. And there's a good argument under the generally accepted accounting principles that income would go to the...
And what does that mean in terms of if we get a settlement from the Dinkum Sands case, and money from that goes into, if we adopt this, then part of that money that goes in there would be earnings to the permanent fund, which means it would go into dividends and inflate and whatever statutory covered. And the other way is it would go right into the fund as principal. You'd count it as principal, and you wouldn't divide it between up statutorily the way it's provided for currently.
That is essentially correct, Mr. Chair. What we're suggesting here is that if it is found under generally accepted accounting principles that those earnings should be accounted for as earnings, then they would not flow to the corpus of the fund, but go through the revenue mechanisms of the permanent fund corporation.
Mr. Chairman, may I just try to lodge it through here? Let's say, for an example, we had $50 million due to us, and that's what the final settlement says, $50 million. Plus interest. Now, if we had that $50 million originally, that would have gone to the corpus, but the interest earned would go to the earnings reserve. But what we're saying here, if we had $50 million and it took us 5 years to settle it, that $50 million in the interest during those 5 years would all go to the corpus. Is that correct?
Actually, if you had it and the interest earned, the income from that, part of 50% would go to dividends based on the formula, and then a certain amount would go to inflation proofing, and only what's a portion of it would go to the earnings reserve.
Well, that's partially right. The dividends in the inflation proofing really is what reduces the earnings reserve balance. So in some ways, it's the same account. I think the question before us that we're trying to answer, if the $50 million would have came in timely, then the interest earned would have gone to the permanent fund and so forth. But we're saying if it didn't come in timely, and therefore the principal and the interest should all go to the corpus. It's whichever way you feel it.
That's how it's been done in the past. And you know, it's strange to think of money that somebody, some other organization has made as part of our net income. I mean, we didn't have anything to do with the investment of it. We don't know what the rate of return was. It's not really net income produced by the permanent fund.
So, if
but
we,
what the rate of return was due to the settlement agreement.
That's correct. You know, and to elaborate on Representative Larson's comments there, with the $50 million that has come in and has been put aside for litigation purposes, let's say that there's $10 or $20 million of earnings that are attributable to that $50 million. So that when that total $70 comes into the Permanent Fund Corporation, $50 should be accounted for as corpus and $20 should be accounted for as earnings. That would be the viewpoint of the generally accepted accounting principles.
Of one view of the generally accepted. I mean, I could give you a piece of paper that said the exact opposite from accountants. It really shows what you want to do with the money.
I think it should be in the corpus, and therefore I don't think I support this amendment. And I think we don't have a quorum anymore anyway. Do we? Do we lose our quorum?
Yeah, Ramona should be right outside. Senator Pershaw, would you like to shed any light on this subject?
Nothing positive.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the amendment, but I can count the number of votes are on the table, too.
Okay. How about, today, to do this, how about if we move this down to the bottom of our calendar? Because we don't have a quorum, can't take any action, and...
Can we have Mr. Kelly comment on the sponsor's amendment?
Yeah.
No problem with that. There was one amendment that we were seeking as well. I believe there's a copy of it in your folder. Which would make it clear that taxable municipal or state debt securities, your corporation would be authorized to buy A-rated municipal or state securities as well as A-rated corporate securities.
It's
in a memorandum dated February 20th.
That was what was throwing me off here, February 20th.
It's on the third page of that.
That's already in.
That's a sectional describing what's in the bill now. This is their amendment.
That's
amendment number one. This is the poor showman. So we have three amendments.
Yeah.
Okay. Show.
Yeah, but.
Yeah, we have three amendments.
And the other one,
and then David, and then poor showman.
Oh,
Could I just ask you a quick question about timing?
Sure.
How long do you plan to do clients? When do you start conference? And
we're supposed to
conference
start now.
Conference doesn't start until 11, and I'd like to roll through some bills.
I thought it started at 10, and the floor started at 11.
The floor starts at 11, and conference starts at 11.
Okay. So do you plan to roll here for
yes.
until quarter of 11 or something like that?
Okay. Okay, we have House Judiciary version of Senate Bill 39 before us. Representative McLean.
Yes, I'd like to offer an amendment dated 4/29/92 to, and it's the Cook version.
Is there objection?
I haven't found it. I'm not sure I know what
that's
you're
the
talking
one.
About.
The one right there.
And this is dealing with conflict of interest?
Yes.
Right.
Any investment officers.
Okay.
There are objections. Without objections, that's adopted. The permanent funds amendment recommendation?
That would be amendment number 2.
Right. What is it currently?
The judiciary version authorizes the corporation to invest in single A-rated corporate bonds. This just clarifies that that includes municipal and state corporate A-rated bonds. Currently, the corporation only invests in double A corporate bonds of any kind.
This is something you guys support.
It is. The study shows that you can make a bit more money investing in single A bonds. On average, over the last 10 years, about 34 basis points, a couple of million dollars a year for us. Without any risk that the investment officers have any problem with.
Okay, I'll move the permanent fund recommended amendment.
Amendment number 2.
Is there objection? Without objection, that's adopted. Representative Larson?
Yeah, I'll move the amendment number 1. Chairman?
Amendment number 3. Is there objection?
Objection.
There is objection.
Okay, which one is this now? This looks like an official
discussion. Should we have our auditor, Mr. Welker, testify briefly in regards to this?
Jim? Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Randy Welker, legislative auditor. You've heard two different opinions here of what is the proper accounting treatment. In my opinion, I agree with Mr. Andrews that money that is coming in is properly interest income of the fund and should be accounted for as income and not as principal of the fund. Basically, it's a timing issue, as Representative Larson described. Mr. Kelly's position, I believe, is looking at it a little more narrowly as income of the corporation. Their view is they didn't earn the money, therefore it shouldn't be counted as their income. But what we're talking about is accounting for the fund. And the fund goes beyond the time that the corporation has the money. It's the time the state has earned the money that interest clock would start running. Therefore, that money is properly interest income. It should be accounted for and treated as interest income, which would mean it would go to the earnings reserve, be available for appropriation for dividends or inflation proofing or other purposes.
Say we had $50 million and with our constitutional amendments and such, we probably couldn't do it now, but if we had $50 million that was being in escrow somewhere, that was gaining interest, okay? And we won or settled or whatever, went into the general fund, or even into the constitutional budget reserve, okay? We took that amount of money, and we deposited it in the permanent fund. How would the interest that were earned in escrow be counted by the fund?
The way it is currently being accounted for, or the way it should be? The way it should be is the corpus, the $50 million, the bonus money, the royalty, that money that was earned from the oil should go to the corpus. The interest that money earned while in escrow should be recorded and reported as income of the permanent fund.
If we make a deposit from the general fund into the permanent fund, and we say that this is a $50 million deposit, a portion of this, of course, was earnings that were generated, and so you reduce it back to whatever the value would have been in principal and count that as earnings of the fund?
If you're making just a general appropriation from the general fund to the permanent fund, I believe that the appropriation language typically dictates that you're making a $50 million appropriation to the corpus of the fund, and that would go in its entirety to the corpus of the fund.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, what we're suggesting in this amendment, too, does not in any way prohibit the legislature from moving income of the permanent fund corporation to the corpus through the appropriation process.
Mr. Chairman, if I might go on with that. As is current practice with inflation proofing, you have statutory provisions that dictate what the income of the fund will be used for. And I believe there are legal opinions, and that's why we have front sections in each year's operating budget that make an appropriation for dividends, that make an appropriation for inflation proofing. And that's because there are legal opinions that can't happen automatically. It takes an appropriation by the legislature to accomplish those statutory provisions. And that's why also, because this issue has been before us for a couple years now, we have that front section also that appropriates money, interest earned while in escrow, to the principal of the fund. So as long as we're using that kind of appropriation language in the Appropriation Act, the end result is going to be that interest income is going to end up in the corpus of the fund, but only through the appropriation process.
Is there further discussion? Kelly, would you like to offer a rebuttal?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We want the language that is in the judiciary substitute incorporated into law that has reflected legislative desires in the past. Every time this has happened in the past, you have supported it, including in the principle. And unless something's changed, although there is a statutory authorization and an appropriation, we like the two to match.
Okay, and is there further discussion? Secretary, call the roll.
Captain Brown?
No.
Representative Copeman?
Yes.
Representative Larson?
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
No.
Representative Sharp?
No.
Representative Warner?
Yes.
Representative Boyer?
No.
Representative Barnes?
Yes.
Representative Navarre?
No.
Representative McLean? Four yeas, five nays.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ready for motion?
Mr. Chairman, I think that I need a little more time to look at this bill. I think it's very complicated. I think it has far-reaching impact, and I would like you to hold it for a little while.
I think I need a little bit of time, too. We heard from our auditors. We heard.
I think it would be fair. Mike, I think it would be fair because I frankly haven't had a chance to even look at the title, much less the body of the bill. Yeah. So, I mean.
Okay, we'll take it up this afternoon.
I haven't seen it. I mean, you know how it is. We were here at 1 o'clock this morning.
I agree. Okay, let's take up Senate Bill 211.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to have a Senate Bill 211 heard. This is the identical piece of legislation to House Bill 318, which Representative Betty Davis has introduced, and we've been working to get the bill moved through the process. Basically, what the bill would do is it would allow all advanced nurse practitioners to be reimbursed under Medicaid. Under current state law, Alaska only allows nurse midwives, family, and pediatric nurse advanced nurse practitioners in independent practice to enroll as Medicaid providers. And this creates a discrepancy that is inconsistent with our Constitution, and that's one of the reasons for introducing the piece of legislation to get us out of the bind. But, however, in the real interest with this legislation is that it is, in a way, a health care access bill. In many smaller communities, there is no access to health care. And people who are Medicaid eligible cannot get health care because a nurse practitioner in the community is not eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. And therefore, what usually happens in these smaller communities is that in order for people even simply to have prescriptions written, the physician has to be flown in order for the entity to get, the clinics to get the coverage under Medicare and Medicaid. So the bill, in a sense, would do two things that would fix a potential problem with respect to an inconsistency with our Constitution, and also it places it gives people the opportunity to access health care in particularly rural communities. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions unless Representative Davis has any comments.
Representative Phillips. Virginia, I'm always leery adding more things to this laundry list. That, you know, my first suspicion is going to add more money to it, but correct me if my impression is right or wrong, that in the long term, this will probably save money because you're sending the nurses out instead of doctors. That's not reflected in the fiscal, though.
No, Mr. Chairman, if I may, you are absolutely correct. There are studies that have been done on a national level that indicate that when nurses provide health care under the Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement system, that there is a reduction in the cost of care. So there is a cost savings that is not reflected in the fiscal note.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, for purposes of discussion, I move that we adopt the House CS for Senate Bill number 211.
Okay.
Is there objection?
I thought we already had it.
No.
Without objection, we have that.
Mr. Chairman, I would. I'm going to propose that we move advanced nurse practitioners to number 4, and move everything else, bump everything back down. And some people feel uneasy about any of this, but we started a bad practice a couple years ago, and that was bringing new services on and putting them at the bottom of the list. This clinical social workers, psychologist services, and chiropractic services all cost money. They access the system and cost money. This saves money, and we ought to acknowledge that and put it more appropriately on the list. And so I'm going to propose that we move it to where chiropractic services is, and then bump the other three back down. We've done that in other bills we passed. We passed the rehab option. We recognized where its relative significance in the overall scheme of services are. And so this doesn't do any harm to a priority system. This is a correct prioritization of this particular service, I think. We just got into a practice because people were literally buying themselves on here last year and the year before, and I disagreed with it then, but I think if we're going to continue to add services, we ought to really put them on a priority list. And so I think that by putting advanced nurse practitioners instead of number 1, putting them at number 4 actually does reflect their relative importance.
The only problem is that we're running out of time. You know, and that if we change that means a concurrence in the Senate.
We've already changed it.
The Senate's only
moved. Oh, it's already changed today. Okay, so that's not a problem. Eh?
Well, ask Virginia, Chairman. I mean, is that a problem? If it's a problem, we obviously won't want to do it. But my guess is that's probably not a problem.
Well, it would be a problem, perhaps, in the sense that originally when the bill was introduced, because of the constitutional issue and because they would be providing basic health care services, the recommendation was that they be placed down on number 17 so that they would be, in a sense, the last to go because of basic services. In Senate Finance, through an amendment introduced by Senator Adams, the order was changed. And, as far as I'm concerned, in the sense that I have, is that even though the nurses are on the top of the list, that entities that are providing basic services, I think that they have some flexibility. They did not eliminate basic services. So I think it's helpful to have it, obviously, further down the line. If it is a cost-saving measure, which I believe that it is, then it would make sense to have it down further so that it will save money to allow the services, you know, beyond that to be funded. But I'll just leave it to the committee, and I would hope that it wouldn't trip up the bill is my only concern.
Representative Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a service that is currently being provided by more costly professionals. We're not adding a particular service that's not being paid for by state funds at the present time, and it's all presently being paid for out of general funds.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, there is a general fund expense, but what is happening, as I mentioned earlier, is that two things are happening. Number one, people are not do not have access to health care. Number two, and based on the testimony that we had on the teleconference last year, that in many communities they were finding that they had to fly a physician in merely to prescribe medications and to provide some of the coverage. So there is a cost savings even that I believe is not only due to the fact that you will be able to use professionals to provide the same service at a lower cost, and I think that will offset any increase with respect to access to health care.
I guess what I'm getting at is, are we going to be paying more for this, but the feds are going to be sharing in it, but is it going to be expanded to where actually our costs are going to go up?
I believe that the way it all works, it would be a neutral to negative cost to the state. Or positive cost, so it wouldn't be a cost.
I'd feel more comfortable, too, moving that into a higher priority class, because one of these days we're not going to fund the lower end of it, and it's probably coming real soon.
Well, in this budget, we're not funding clinical social workers, psychologists, or chiropractors.
So it doesn't do much good to add it if we're not going to fund it.
Well, we are funding dental.
We are funding dental. That's emergency dental.
Mm-hmm. So I will defer to the wishes of the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move that we move it from 1 to 4 and then bump it.
Okay, why are you doing that now again? Do you think it's a lower priority than what?
It's a higher priority. The list works from the lowest priority. And in our budget, and I think the Senate has budget, and Tom or someone else that's been following both sides may know, but we didn't fund what is here 2, 3, or 4. And the Senate did likewise, is that correct? So we're not.
Remove section 2 in the judiciary version, which runs from line 12, page 1, through page, or line 3, page 2. Line 3, yeah, page 2, line 3. You want them all in one? Or
sure.
And then I would move that we add.
From the original version.
From the original version, lines on page 2, lines 1 through 4.
Does everyone understand the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
In the title change.
And
the
title change.
Amendment.
Title change on line 2, page 1, removing and in the United States Congress.
Discussion of the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment?
I'd just like to ask
Representative Brown.
What is the status at the federal level of the other states that have adopted terms limiting?
There's only 3.
The congressional terms. Have they held up in court? Or
yes, they all have.
California did.
Colorado, Oklahoma.
Are they held up in court?
Mm-hmm.
Even the U.S. Congress?
Mm-hmm. No, there was a recent court case in the state of Washington that had to do with limiting terms on the local government level that the courts threw the term limitations out.
Because the state of Washington rejected it, the term limitation.
No,
I've always thought it was a stretch, but anyway, we have a new CS before us that incorporates the first Boyer Amendment and now the Sharp Amendment that limits the bill essentially to the terms. There was no objection to the Sharp Amendment. So without objection, that amendment has been adopted with the title change language amendment as well. Is there further discussion on the CS? Representative Kopanen?
I move that the CF next to me refer with individual recommendations.
And the accompanying fiscal.
And the accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so ordered. Well, let's see what other kind of damage we can get into.
Could
what
we
break
this?
A little bit before Tom gives us a chance to go down? Why don't we, I think we may as well break then to a call of a chair. So House Finance will recess to the call of a chair. Sign this.